Hello and welcome to the Women in Sport podcast. Our vision is that no one is excluded from the joy, fulfillment and lifelong benefits of sport. In this episode, we continue our deep dive into the needs and experiences of a particular group of teenage girls. This is part two of our deep dive into why Black British girls fall out of love with sport at such an alarming rate. In part one, we looked at elite sport. In this episode, our focus is on grassroots. Black girls tell us they want sport to be a safe space where they really belong and fit in. But the older they get, the more challenging they find it to continue. Too often, they feel unwelcome, singled out, and having to contend with racist stereotyping.
I think they need something that is more than a one-off. There's so many initiatives that pop up and then pop away.
We always say the conversation's been had, but the conversation's been really had. We're having this conversation properly. I do think sport is listening.
If we could not afford to go somewhere, it would usually be funded. If we could not afford the equipment, it would normally be provided. And most importantly, within the schools, the amount of sport we were given access to was humongously different.
I'm Julia George. I'm a broadcaster and former gymnast. With me today are Lee Bailey, a community engagement manager at the Black Swimming Association, which was founded in 2020 to address a lack of water confidence and skills, and crucially to reduce drowning among racially diverse communities, especially Black Brits. Bumi Jurawuju is a presenter and leader in tech, a mum of four and a rugby coach and player. She says while she's no longer the fastest player on the pitch, she does warn the younger players, Auntie can still take you down. And Joanne Agutemen is an associate director at Humankind Research. Humankind conducted our qualitative research with Black British teenage girls, which has inspired this podcast. Let's start off with everyone explaining their relationship with sport. So Joanne, to you first of all, as a Black girl in Britain, how was sport for you?
It was fun at the beginning. There was a lot of, I love rounders, I love dodgeball. I was dabbling in football and basketball and netball. So it started out really fun. And I think it quickly transitioned into talking about kind of exercise and movement. And I just didn't feel like that was something I was good at. And I was always craving, like I would try Zumba, I would try dance classes, something that moved my body, but didn't necessarily feel like exercise. I think my perception of it was just quite negative. And I feel like as an adult now, I'm finally at that place where I'm enjoying movement. I'm going to the gym. I'm being consistent. I'm excited at what my body can do. And I've really shifted my mind to the fact that, no, this is a privilege. This is exciting.
Lee, what was sport like for you growing up?
In primary school, all sports were available. So we tried everything. And when we went into secondary school, there's still so much more available. So I was actually did fencing and I actually fenced for the school so you could go around the boroughs. So we tried to join everything. Because with that, you could travel to different schools within your borough. And
everything,
compete.
Everything except football, right? Because of the generation we are.
100%, yeah. So, yeah, I don't even remember. My dad actually ran a football club, managed a football club, and I never engaged in football. I used to go to the training sessions with him, with my sister, but it wasn't even open at school that any, what we call boys' sports, they were called boys' sports, and we did girls' sports. I think we did sports day that we were mixed and that as well. So I had a family where you had to engage in a sport. So sport was always natural. We watched lots of sports. We had tennis every year. My mum watched Wimbledon for 2 weeks. We knew we couldn't watch anything else but Wimbledon. So for us, sport has always been part of our life and fun.
What about you, Bumi?
Yeah, and I mentioned before, we have a slightly different generation from you. And so that the access to sports from an early age was there, it was for the picking, it was free, it was provided by the local councils. And so very similar, really, from primary school, dabbling into everything from netball to cricket to rounders, and then on to secondary school as well. So sport has followed me through all of my educational moments. When I went to university, I played netball and I ran for Oxford, and then I came out and started having my own children and swam. I remember swimming, getting my swimming back up to scratch when I was pregnant.
When you discovered that teenage Black girls in Britain now are dropping out of sport at a higher rate than any other group of girls, does that frustrate you, given your relationship with sport was so great?
It's shocking. It's sad. I I'm not surprised. They are put into a very different sporting environment and ecosystem than I was put into. If we could not afford to go somewhere, it would usually be funded. If we could not afford the equipment, it would normally be provided. And most importantly, within the schools, the amount of sport we were given access to was humongously different from what the girls are now experiencing.
Joanne, let's talk about the research. So Women in Sport identified that Black girls are in this unique position. They have the highest dream rates. This is from our own dream deficit research. They see themselves as sporty. And yet they have the lowest participation rate of any group of girls. How did you go about discovering what was going on? What did you do at Humankind?
We spoke to the girls themselves. I think a big part of the research was understanding, not jumping straight into their sporting lives, just understanding them as girls. What is it like to be a Black girl in the UK today?
What has struck you most from your research?
I think for me, it was the number of stories and scenarios we heard of girls being put into a box, girls being typecast and stereotyped ultimately. So things like, because you're Jamaican, you should be really good at sprinting. That really struck me because it showed me how all of the things I'm sure we're all aware of in terms of the way that Black women are seen in the world, it showed me how that's impacting Black girls and how it wears away at them over time. There's only so much of that you can take and they love it. After so many of those scenarios and being boxed in and not being allowed to explore the sport as you want, that wears away at you and it wears away at your love of the sport.
Let's pick up on typecasting. Lee, has it ever happened to you or have you seen it happen to Black girls?
I'm with the BSA, so I can talk about swimming as well. I mean, the major typecast about stereotype about Black people is they don't float or they can't float because we've got heavier bones. So that's just, and that's a generational thing. And it's also passed down from generation. If the family member believes it, it's passed on. So different things like that, I think, are stereotype. But in young girls, when I did a project with them, it seemed to be that, one, they'd heard that stereotype because obviously we were dealing with water. Two, they were talking about their hair being ruined, their skin being really dry afterwards because of the chlorine affecting them. So I think it was, I hate to say lack of education, but generationally not being educated in that sport because it's a belief, because it's been heard so many times and it's passed on.
Is this coming just from the Black girls and their families themselves, or does this come from white people's perceptions about Black people in swimming too?
I mean, I think white people are surprised when a Black girl or person can swim well. It's the same as with runners. When you get someone that can run well, the first thing they comment on is the fact that her hair's like that and her nails like that, that she can still run and look like that. There's more emphasis on how she looks when she's doing it rather than what she's actually achieved. I think if you hear it, the whole thing about myth is a myth, isn't it? But if you hear it long enough, it becomes institutionalised and families will believe it.
Joanne, you wanted to come back in on that idea of appearances, I think.
Yeah, just to add to, I guess, the concept of kind of perceptions and stereotypes. In the research, we talked about representation. Mm-hmm. And we all know it's important. We know that there needs to be a lot of it. There needs to be the right kind of representation. But also the fact that if there's a void of representation, people are going to fill those voids with stories that they already have, the biases that they have. So it just made me think of why representation is so important, because without it, that those kind of stereotypes get perpetuated.
What about typecasting in rugby? What have you seen in rugby, Boomi?
Yeah, and I just wanted to quickly talk about this, and especially from the swimmer perspective as well, because the skin, the hair, it requires management, and we will talk about that from a rugby perspective as well. There are generally difficulties in terms of going into the pool with your braids or with your natural hair, getting it all wet and coming out, and you just don't get to wash and go and shake it out. And that should just be said. And so we very quickly move on to how can we empower those girls, boys, whoever, to manage that. And I feel that we need to very quickly start saying these are the ways for it to be easier, and that's from a family perspective.
I love this about you. Yeah. You see this as an opportunity.
Yes.
You're not about putting these Black girls in a victim box.
No, absolutely not. Because I think that this is great because you've given them a voice. Mm. This is great because we've highlighted some of the things that need to be fixed. And now this is great because, like we said, some of them are actually easy. And it's who do you trust to tell you what the solution is? All right. If I come and say to a girl, actually, do you know what? Have a good wash, put your lotion on first and then layer on with some oil and then do that. They will hear that from me. They may not hear that from, I don't know, their white coach or anybody who doesn't know, because you wouldn't know. In terms of typecasting for rugby, super interesting when it comes to, I think, black girls. Number one, it is a very similar thing. Are you going to be the fastest on the pitch? And fastest tend to be at the back on the wings. So you can imagine that's probably going to be where they'll be put. That said, I will, in defence of rugby, say that it's a sport that embraces all shapes and sizes. So literally, I think I was watching Saracens the other day, and it was one black girl on the pitch, and she was much fuller, and she was actually in the front, and she was a forward. But that's already going to require an understanding and embracing what your body can do, strengths of that body, and where you are on the pitch. But also, if you're bored in a position, you're not going to come back the next week. So like coaching, people who are leading need to understand where they should be putting positioning children and on the pitch.
The girls who don't come back, the girls who drop out, the girls for whom this research is all about, because this is about trying to give them these opportunities to stay and find the solutions. What are we hearing from them? What did you learn about why they stopped?
The first thing that stood out to me was we heard that they're really aware of the benefits of sport. They're aware that it's for their health, it's for their mental health, it's community, it's where they found their close friends. So that awareness is there. It's the wearing down over time of all these negative experiences, of not feeling like you can have fun, of feeling like there's so much pressure on your shoulders because of the expectations that other people have just because you're a black girl. That is a lot of the things that we heard from the letters. It's not necessarily I don't want to do it. It's I've loved you, I've always loved you, but it doesn't feel like you love me back. It doesn't feel like sports is saying that I'm welcome here, that I can bring my full self here. And that theme of belonging came up really strongly in the research. Black girls just wanted a space where they felt like they could be their full selves, and sport wasn't always providing that space.
How important is it for the black girls to feel they're in a safe space, that there are other black girls in that sporting environment, in their team, in the gym, on the track, wherever it is?
So important. Like directly from one of the girls, they talked about the fact that a safe space for black girls is amongst other black girls. And they said it really clearly and really beautifully. And it's really hard when you're the only black girl. And they talked about that time and time again. When you come into a sports space, you're the only black girl, and there's not an explicit attempt made to make you feel comfortable in that space. Again, it just feels like you're hyper visible. There's all this pressure, and it just makes it not fun.
Does that happen in swimming? If there's still so few black girls in swimming, is that one of the problems? It doesn't feel like a safe space because there's not somebody else who looks like you. I was talking in our other podcast about our black girls research with Kadina Cox, the amazing paracyclist and athlete, who said when she first started cycling, there was no one who looked like her. How does that affect you and affect girls in swimming, would you say, Lee?
You need someone to aspire to. You need to see something that makes you think, I really want to try this, let alone to find out whether you're good at it or not. So if you don't see it, you don't want to do it. You don't want to be it. So it takes a lot of courage for a young girl to go, I'm going to try this sport, I'm going to be good at it, and I'm going to be the best at it, let alone or just enjoy it, if they don't see their counterpart or themselves in that sport. And if, like you said before, with coaches and teachers, if you get a person that doesn't understand either their culture or their aspects or where the girls are coming from, it's going to be really hard for them to engage and feel welcome and understood, you know? I mean, and let alone just being a teenage girl.
This is very important. And it's this whole thing I'm saying about opportunity and flipping the script a bit. When you look at the women's football team and the women's pro rugby team, to get their hair out of the way, white girls are now adopting black women's style of hairstyling to carry out their sports.
Because it's still an expression as well, isn't it?
It's an expression, but it's also actually functional. Mm-hmm. So why are we allowing that to happen and then seeing when we're doing our cornrows or our braids, it's seen as disadvantage. However, our same hairstyling is being used to be practical for non-black.
And I wasn't surprised that hair came up so much in the research. I'm actually glad it came up, not glad that they're facing barriers, but I think it really showed the power of speaking to the girls directly. I'm not sure if we would have heard about this if we didn't go directly to Absolutely. The girls. And also having black researchers that understand when they're talking about hair, it's not this frivolous thing. It's expensive. It takes time.
Yes.
And understanding that from a lived experience.
Yeah.
How did black teenage girls build up trust in sport? Mm-hmm. And how do they rebuild it, Joanne? Because trust comes up a lot, doesn't it, in the research?
Yeah, it did. And I think one of the most interesting stories around trust was a girl that was talking about the fact that she found this football club that was specifically for black girls. And she almost didn't trust it. Like, she became very suspicious. She was like, is this a scam? And she couldn't quite understand why she felt that way, because it was something that she'd always wanted to see. And then when she saw it, it felt like it came out of the blue. And I think that speaks directly to the importance of, you need to do the consistent work of building trust. It might not happen on the first go. It might not happen on the second. So that's why I really love the stuff that like Gymshark is doing with Ruka and investing in black hair and the sweatbands and things like that, because they're building that trust and that right to kind of speak to black girls and put on initiatives for black girls.
How did swimming lose black girls' trust in order to have to win it back? Because
I don't think you ever had it. I'm not going to be honest.
Looking for it now?
Yeah, I mean, it's a white sport. Most aquatics is a white sport. So it's only changed now. I mean, if you look at sailing or rowing, they all cost a lot of money. They're quite an old institution. And they're normally clubs that you have to belong to and everything like that. So to get into them is hard. I come from an East London school. We didn't do any aquatics. We didn't go to like rowing or anything like that. That was a choice. I mean, it's crazy because my sister is actually a rower when she grew up. And she's the only person I knew of colour that actually rowed. And I don't know how she got into it, actually. I think she was with a white friend. And she went with her one day and did really well. But I've never, ever seen a person of colour doing any of those sports. So I don't think we came out of it. I just don't think we were ever in it.
I love what you've said there, because it's the reality of where we are living in the UK. You know, we talked about jumping off points. Mm. And I think once we understand that I am not ever going to see the majority of black women rowing. I am not going to live where I live and see a critical mass, because I don't live in a black area per se, a critical mass of black women playing rugby. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen. And being able to say, and that's fine. However, regardless of whether you're a minority, a majority, a mass or not, you can come in there and do your thing. Yeah. I think that's the moment when we start again understanding what the jobs to be done are. I would be disingenuous to say, oh, my daughter's the only black girl playing in her year. Yeah, she's going to be. That's where we live. If I then, however, want to let her have this beautiful safe space that you talk about, there needs to be some thinking about where do we then go to find that. So if I want her to see people that look like her playing rugby, I put on the South African rugby women's team and I like, watch that. And I was like, you got all shapes and sizes going on there. And those girls are bad. They are amazing. If we want to go and see, and you will probably be able to find somewhere where we will and can see some black women rowing, there has to be this understanding that we're going to have to somehow look out some outside our communities at some point to get that nourishment and then bring it in with a kind of a reality. Am I making sense?
Yeah, you are. And it speaks to family, actually.
Yes.
Because you are speaking as a mum about what you want your daughter to be able to see, because you're also really realistic about it not being on your doorstep. And I know, even regardless of the colour of their skin, you have to go and find girls from other clubs to even put a girls' rugby team together,
yes.
Don't you?
Yes. For her age group, yeah. Yes.
So families. Problem, solution, both. What do you say, Joanne? What do you learn in the research about families when it comes to the black girls and their relationship with sport?
I think it's twofold. And one thing that I didn't mention in my kind of story of sport was the fact that, and I'm not surprised this came up in the research, your schooling, your education, your career, like those are the things that families are pushing first and foremost, because as black people, we're concerned with social mobility. You know, your parents want you to do better than they did. They want you to have better than they had. So it all makes sense. So a lot of the time, the priority from families is education and not necessarily sports.
And yet the research shows increasingly that sport and particularly team sport, boosts girls' chances, all girls' chances of getting to the top in organisations, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But is that the narrative that mum would hear back at home from daughter who has been told, oh, that's great, you know, go and do netball? Will at that same conversation, that daughter will say, I've been put in the netball team and I'm also going to be, I've just been told that I can now be in the top group for triple science, right? Are those conversations happening in concert? Or is it a case of, oh, hold on a minute, all the kids who are doing triple science or in a grammar school or in elite education environments, they're not doing a bunch of sports. So why are you, beautiful black girl, being pushed to go and do a bunch of sports? And this is the conversation about the trust, because you know, and I know, and I definitely feel they go side by side. And I told you my background, because it's always gone side by side. And I've often used sporting aid scenarios to encourage people within tech and corporations and vice versa. So we know that. However, mum back at home, dad back home, do they know that? Who are the people that have been talking to their children? And have they been giving them all of the opportunity, academic, career-wise, and sports? Or has there been a movement of the dial up and down? So it's a trust. Where's the messaging coming from?
Families. In your world of sport, Lee, both the sport you've lived throughout your life and the sport that you work in now, what's their job?
Well, I think I was lucky because obviously I said I came from parents that pushed us to do sports and academics. We had to do a sport as a requirement. But for me, with the families and the people, the communities I work with, a lot of it is whether the parents have time. Mm. It's not necessarily that they don't want their children to do sports or they think academics is more important. It's do they have the time, the money, the energy to be able to show for their kids from their sessions? And if you're getting into elite sports or sports where you're actually committed to it, like sports clubs, your start's at 5 a.m. There's meets you have to go to. So, I mean, from when I was growing up, like we said earlier, everything was provided, everything was affordable as well, so that's a big aspect as well. So it's not necessarily what I tend to find is a lot of parents would like to do more, but emotionally and physically and financially can't.
Some of the girls in the research jam were saying that, or there was one in particular that really struck me, and she was making the point that she doesn't think that the white girls have so much responsibility at home. Chores, to be blunt,
yeah,
and particularly if you're the oldest girl in a black family.
Absolutely. And it's felt on a few different levels. The overarching concept is the adultification of black girls. And at a family level, we did hear that a lot, that it's the eldest daughter responsibility. And in wider culture, this isn't unique to the black community. It's also in the Asian community as well. But it is a very well-known kind of idea that when you're the eldest daughter, there's a lot more responsibility. You almost by default become second mum. And then that means that you have to sacrifice things. And it's not going to be your education. It's going to be your sport in life.
It's hard to say, okay, how would we fix that per se? Because that is the family structure and construct. And so is it to be fixed or is there to be an additional sort of layer to that?
I love the idea of the girl. I've got two teenagers. Like the idea that they do enough chores. I mean, I'm really going to make them lean into this podcast.
100%. I mean, I'm the oldest and I am the second mum. I class myself as the second mum. I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah.
I'm there to look after my brother and sister and I'm with my mum. But all of us were made to equally know how to do things around the house so that when we grew up, we knew how to look after ourselves and that sort of thing. I've come from a mixed heritage family as well, so I don't know if that makes a slight bit of difference. My mum's English and my dad's Jamaican, but I'd say we brought up more West Indian, like more West Indian traditional home. But I think that was just how we was brought up. And I think it's a lovely, it's a good thing to have, but I can understand how in some households that might mean that the girls are taken away from other aspects of what they're doing.
Yeah. And I think that's what I was trying to bring out in terms of, it's not, is it going to be an either or? Probably
it
not.
Be, should it? It shouldn't be, hopefully. Definitely.
Let's try to throw down the gauntlet to sport, to the girls, to media and schools and everything that influences black girls' experience and needs in sport. Who wants to go first? You do.
I've got an Lee. I've got a slight one. I think we touched on it earlier, and the work we've done, I've done so far, is if sport itself and organisations and everything, if they want to be more inclusive, is why are they doing it? What are they doing it for? If they're doing it just to tick a box, to say that we are now more inclusive and that as well, because girls see through this. The conversations I've had with girls, they're just like, okay, well, we did a really good course. It was great fun. And then that was it. What are you going to do long term? Can we look at this 5 years' time and say, right, this started something and it's moving and it's now, we don't have to talk about it because it's happening naturally. It's the same with advertising. Do we see this kind of advertising because it's now fashionable to see it? Are we talking about girls today because it's fashionable to make sure that girls get into sport? And the next one, are you going to carry on with this long term?
Opportunities. This is something that you feel really strongly about. I know, Bumi. What is the opportunity from this Women in Sport research, from the brilliant research that Humankind have done and the campaign we want to lead now?
I'm going to throw that down the gauntlet to the girls and the families, in a sense. The girls, in that this work, this research, all this effort has given them a microphone. And sometimes it's easier for somebody else to send your message, and they should be happy. And I'm so happy that you got the contribution that you did, that you got there. The families, in that for them to become more open-minded about what sport can provide. And I think it's a bit loaded even just saying sport, because we're picturing people being on the pitch, people being doing stuff. However, the opportunity to be involved in all the myriad of sport, with sport being the umbrella, is huge. And so from a social mobility perspective, from a finance perspective, from a career perspective, from being, I don't know, from a physio to be a physio on the pitch, to an agent, to somebody who does sponsorships, someone who's doing the agreements, you can be the lawyer and still be part of sport. To open up your mindset around that and then embracing what those opportunities can be. And then finally, I think the trust piece, I will continue to say the trust piece. This research, social media and everything, as you said, people know. People know when someone's just doing something because it's trendy. People know when there's an agenda. Don't disrespect the fact that people understand what it is that people are trying to do. And so ensure that you build trust if you really expect the girls to participate in all those different ways.
Final word to Joanne. Who do you throw down the gauntlet to? You spent the time with the girls. What do you think they need and want?
I think they need something that is more than a one-off. There's so many initiatives that pop up and then pop away. Like, they really need time. They need consistency. They need investment. It's not enough to do something once. And we need to understand what we've learned from this research is that there's been a lot of negative experiences. There's going to need to be time for healing. There's going to need to be, as you say, Bumi, time to build trust. And I just don't know how many organisations are willing to put in that time. Like, do you think that this one programme is going to solve everything? It's not. You know, are you willing to spend the next 5 years, the next decade, like, grovelling at the feet of these girls? Because the dynamic has been so unbalanced for so long. Like, this is your time to not make the girls adjust to you, but make sure that the sport world, sporting culture, adjusts to them.
I want to do one last thing. Bumi, what's your cause for optimism in this space?
The different areas of formats that we can send positive messages through now. It used to not be in our control, but I think we can take advantage of sending these positive messages in so many different ways. So that's great. And also that we've got people who will speak up now. We've been through a moment where we were scared or we didn't and what have you, but whereas now it's like, what's the worst that can happen?
Fearless woman. Lee, what about you? Reasons to be optimistic about the future for black British teenage girls?
I think because we always say the conversation's been had, but the conversation's been really had. We're having this conversation properly. I do think sport is listening. One thing I'd notice is that the girls of today are going to be the parents of tomorrow. So will they make sure that their girls have the opportunities to do whatever they didn't get a chance to do? That could make the change. I've seen a lot of parents now making sure their children can swim because they never did learn. I'm optimistic that in 10 years' time, I will still be hearing about this, but as a progression, and it would just be part of what we do.
Joanne, have you got reasons to be optimistic?
Definitely. Like the work of a lot of the organisations on the ground that are putting on these amazing like programmes for black girls, that's kind of opening up the world of sport. It's including Tooth Gems and nail art. It's not just about, it's opening up what sport looks like, essentially. But also, I would say I've seen a lot of run clubs and ski clubs and things that have been started kind of from the black community to make sure that we understand that these spaces are for us, even hiking clubs and things like that. And I think that's something that I find really encouraging. And it points to the fact that there's a real need to just for these spaces that feel like they have been specifically created for us.
Lee, Joanne, Bumi, thank you all so much for joining us on the Women in Sport podcast. That's it for this episode of the Women in Sport podcast. My thanks to my guests, Lee Bailey from the Black Swimming Association, Bumi Jirawuju, who's a tech expert and mum of four and a rugby player, and Joanne Ogutterman from Humankind Research. If you enjoyed this chat, check out the other episodes where we talk about black girls and sport. And there are dozens of other episodes in our archive. Please remember to like, subscribe and rate wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear or you have an idea for a topic you think we should cover, you can also drop us a line. Go to our website, womeninsport.org, where you can sign up to our newsletter and donate to our charity. You can find us on all the usual socials. So follow us and tell us the sports you love and what you're doing to create change. Many thanks to Whistledown Productions in London, where this podcast was recorded. And thank you for listening. My name is Julia George. And remember, everyone should be included in the joy, fulfillment, and lifelong benefits of sport. See you next time.